This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of How Do You Kill 11 Million People by Andy Andrews, published by Thomas Nelson and read by the author.
For many years, I've been asked to speak to political gatherings of one type or another, and for many years, I've consistently declined. Because the books I write are generally regarded as common sense literature, novels that illustrate life's principles, I suppose many politicians have simply assumed that I was on their side. However, I am not an us-or-them kind of person. Actually, I am more of a we person. Don't get me wrong, I do have some absolutes carved into my heart and mind, but I am optimistic enough to believe there is still common ground, even with those of us who might disagree. Don't we all want the best for our country? And a secure and prosperous future for our children? Of course we do. And I believe that we can talk about divisive subjects without screaming at each other. Somehow, for the most part, our parents and grandparents managed to disagree with their neighbors and still remain neighborly. And they usually did it from their front porches. Today, most of us don't even have front porches. We have retreated to the backyard, where a single opinion can be isolated and enforced by a privacy fence. Several years ago, I asked myself these three questions. Where do we begin to find common ground in regard to what we want or don't want for the future of America? Is it possible to write something that doesn't use the words Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, yet conveys a message with which everyone could agree? Can it be written in a concise fashion, allowing anyone to read it, clearly understand the message, and be empowered in less than 15 minutes? Here, then, is my answer to those questions. Andy Andrews, Orange Beach, Alabama. For you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Those are probably the most famous words ever spoken on the subject of truth. Most of us accept that particular sentence at face value. It certainly resonates with our spirit. It just feels right. But what does it mean, really? And have you ever contemplated the meaning that comes to light by inverting this principle? If it is correct that you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, then is it possible that if you don't know the truth, its absence can place you in bondage? As a boy, I quickly learned that if someone found out the truth, I might get in trouble, or I wouldn't get chosen, or I wouldn't be as well liked. Yet my parents urged me to tell the truth, and went so far as to promise I would not be spanked, if only I told the truth. At Heard Elementary School, I told my fourth-grade classmates that Elvis Presley was my cousin. I suppose it was my way of courting popularity at the time, but Elvis was not my cousin. What I had publicly declared in the cafeteria was not true, and for a time, though it didn't seem possible, I became even less popular. It was a good lesson and helped me determine that, in the future, I would tell the truth. Once, when I was 15, a man in our neighborhood told me he would pay me $50 for a particular task of yard work. When I finished, he gave me $20 and said that was the amount upon which we had agreed. It was the first time someone had ever looked me directly in the eye and purposefully told me something that was not true. I took note several years later when he was publicly shamed and financially penalized for another instance, entirely unrelated to me, of not telling the truth. Through my formative years and on into young adulthood, the truth became a touchstone, a goalpost, something to strive for. The truth was always within my sight, usually respected, but sometimes compromised. Once, I watched on television as the President of the United States resigned his office in disgrace. At that time, it didn't occur to me that the nation was in so much turmoil and the President was in so much trouble, not because of what had been done, but because he had lied about it. As an adult, I have become a student of history. For some reason, I am fascinated by what people said and what nations did so many years ago. I am also interested in results, the outcomes these civilizations produced as they reacted to what people said and what nations did so many years ago. I often wonder, Do those outcomes have any bearing on us today? Should we be more careful students of the events and decisions that have shaped the lives and nations of those who have gone before us? A long time ago, I decided that if history were to be of any value in my life, I could not succumb to the temptation of convenience in regard to my personal beliefs or desires. In other words, I would not be able to categorize people and nations as good guys or bad guys to suit my political or religious beliefs. The truth in what I uncovered would have to trump everything I had ever been taught or believed. Quietly, I could only hope that what I had been taught and believed was true. Sometime during my study of the Dark Ages and Middle Ages, I uncovered an odd paradox that exists in our minds about time gone by. It is a difference most people don't discern between history and the past. Simply stated, the past is what is real and true, while history is merely what someone recorded. If you don't think there's a difference, experience an event in person, and then read about it in the newspaper the next day after witnesses have been interviewed. It might be shocking for many of us to realize that what we know as history can actually be a total fabrication created from the imagination of someone with an axe to grind. Or perhaps, and it certainly happened in the Middle Ages, history was simply recorded by the man with the sharpest axe. On into world conquest I read, now aware that to be assured of accurate information, it would be vitally important that I confirm records and stories with transcripts and eyewitness accounts where possible. The records surrounding the life of Joan of Arc, her triumphs, capture, 14-month trial, execution, retrial of nullification 20 years after her death, and subsequent canonization particularly fascinated me. Hundreds of eyewitnesses testified over a period of almost 30 years as to what they personally saw or did not see. Do we know the truth about the life and death of Joan of Arc today? One would hope so. She is the patron saint of soldiers, martyrs, prisoners, and the entire nation of France. World history, for those who continue to study it, becomes more defined during the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly during the American Revolution. Records by opposing forces and differing beliefs remain in relatively good shape and can still be examined by those wishing to do so. The people of our present world retain a general awareness of historical timelines and a few specific dramatic events that shape our lives. We occasionally read history or watch history presented on film. But in terms of why we do what we do, how we govern each other, what our society allows and why, very few of us intentionally connect the truth of the past with the realities of where we have ended up today. So is the truth of the past even important? What about the truth itself? Beyond the elusive moral ideal by which most of us were raised, being honest and doing good, does the truth really, really matter? To answer that question effectively, I would ask you another question. How do you kill 11 million people? Obviously, most of us have never even considered such a thing. Yet when I began to closely research our world's recent history, the last 100 years, that particular question made its unsettling way into my mind. How do you kill 11 million people? 11 million. The number is so large when the word people is attached to it that it becomes almost impossible to take seriously. Why 11 million, you might ask? What is the significance of that number? It is true, there is no singular significance in that number, and the actual number is 11,283,000, the number of people recorded who were killed by Adolf Hitler between the years 1933 and 1945. Incidentally, that particular figure only represents institutionalized killing. It does not include the 5,200,000 German civilians and military war dead. Neither does it include the 28,736,000 Europeans killed during World War II as a result of Hitler's aggressive governmental policies. Within the same parameters, we could have used the number of Cambodians put to death by their own government, slightly more than 3 million, between the years 1975 and 1979. 3 million, from a total population of 8 million. We could have used the exact figure of 61,911,000. That is the number of people who were murdered by the government of the Soviet Union, shown by their own records, between the years 1917 and 1987. But only 54,767,000 of the men, women, and children put to death by the Communist Party were officially Soviet citizens. That is 14,322 human lives for every word in this book. During World War I, the highest leadership council of Turkey's Young Turk government decided to exterminate every Armenian in the country, whether a soldier already on the front lines fighting for the government or a pregnant woman. This government institutionally killed their own famous scholars, their own religious leaders, their own children, and ardent patriots of their own country, all 2 million of them. We could have used that number instead. In fact, during our world's last 100 years, there are many different figures from which to choose. 3 million in North Korea, more than 1 million each in Mexico, Pakistan, and the Baltic states. The choices available and numbers of dead killed at the hands of their own governments are staggering. And in other places around the world, they are just getting started. But for our purpose, let's focus on the number that is probably the most well known to us, the 11 million human beings exterminated by the Nazi regime. There are many lessons we have learned from that tragic period in history, but one particular part of the story remains quietly hidden from even the most brilliant of scholars. It is the answer to one simple question. How do you kill 11 million people? Only a clear understanding of the answer to this question and the awareness of an involved populace can prevent history from continuing to repeat itself as it already has, time and again. To be absolutely clear, the method a government employs in order to do the actual killing is not in question. We already know the variety of tools used to accomplish mass murder. Neither do we need to consider the mindset of those deranged enough to conceive and carry out a slaughter of innocents. History has provided ample documentation of the damage done to societies by megalomaniacal psychopaths or sociopaths. What we need to understand is how 11 million people allow themselves to be killed. Obviously, that is an oversimplification, but think with me here. If a single terrorist begins to shoot automatic weapons in a movie theater containing 300 people, the lone gunman couldn't possibly kill all 300. Why? Because when the shooting started, most of the crowd would run, or hide, or fight. So why, for month after month and year after year, did millions of intelligent human beings, guarded by a relatively few Nazi soldiers, willingly load their families into tens of thousands of cattle cars to be transported by rail to one of the many death camps scattered across Europe? How can a condemned group of people headed for a gas chamber be compelled to act in a docile manner? The answer is breathtakingly simple, and it is a method still being used by some elected leaders to achieve various goals today. How do you kill 11 million people? Lie to them. According to testimony provided under oath by witnesses at the Nuremberg trials, including specific declarations made in court on January 3, 1946, by former SS officers, the act of transporting the Jews to death camps posed a particular challenge for the man who had been named operational manager of the Nazi genocide. Adolf Eichmann, known as the Master, was directed by written order in December 1941 to implement the final solution. Eichmann went about the task as if he were the president of a multinational corporation. He set ambitious goals, recruited enthusiastic staff, and monitored the progress. He charted what worked and what didn't, and changed policy accordingly. Eichmann measured achievement in quotas filled. Success was rewarded, failure was punished. An intricate web of lies, to be delivered in stages, was designed to ensure the cooperation of the condemned but unknowing Jews. First, As barbed wire fences were erected, encircling entire neighborhoods, Eichmann or his representatives met with Jewish leaders to assure them that the physical restrictions being placed upon their community, in what later became known as ghettos, were only temporary necessities of war. As long as they cooperated, he told them, no harm would come to those inside the fence. Second, bribes were taken from the Jews in the promise of better living conditions. The bribes convinced the Jews that the situation was indeed temporary and that no further harm would befall them. After all, they reasoned, why would the Nazis accept bribes if they only intend to kill us and take everything anyway? These first two stages of deception were conducted to prevent uprisings or even escape. Finally, Eichmann would appear before a gathering of the entire ghetto. Accompanied by an entourage of no more than 30 local men and officers of his own, many unarmed, he addressed the crowd in a strong, clear voice. According to sworn statements, these were very likely his exact words. Jews, at last it can be reported to you that the Russians are advancing on our eastern front. I apologize for the hasty way we brought you into our protection. Unfortunately, there was little time to explain. You have nothing to worry about. We want only the best for you. You will leave here shortly and be sent to very fine places indeed. You will work there. Your wives will stay at home and your children will go to school. You will have wonderful lives. We will all be terribly crowded on the trains, but the journey is short. Men, please keep your families together and board the rail cars in an orderly manner. Quickly now, my friends. We must hurry. The Jewish husbands and fathers were relieved by the explanation and comforted by the fact that there weren't more armed soldiers. They helped their families into the rail cars. The containers, designed to transport 8 cows, were each packed with a minimum of 100 human beings and quickly padlocked. At that moment, they were lost. The trains rarely stopped until well inside the gates of Auschwitz, or Belzec, or Sobibor, or Treblinka. A list drawn up by the German ministry in 1967 names more than 1,100 concentration camps and subcamps accessible by rail. The Jewish Virtual Library says it is estimated that the Nazis established 15,000 camps in the occupied countries. And that is how you kill 11 million people. Lie to them. But wait, you say, this didn't happen overnight. How did things get so out of hand? How did it get to this point? The National Socialist German Workers' Party, led by Adolf Hitler, rose to power during a time of economic uncertainty in a nation of people longing for better times. Germany was a modern, industrialized nation whose well-informed citizens enjoyed ready access to information by way of print and radio broadcast media. Hitler was a man of the common people. Not long before, he had been an army lieutenant, and his speeches were exciting and passionate. He promised more and better and new and different. He vowed rapid change and swift action. According to record, what Hitler actually said in his speeches depended very much upon the audience. In agricultural areas, he pledged tax cuts for farmers and new laws to protect food prices. In working-class neighborhoods, he talked about redistribution of wealth and attacked the high profits generated by business owners. When he appeared before financiers or captains of industry, Hitler focused on his plans to destroy communism and reduce the power of the trade unions. How fortunate for leaders, Hitler said to his inner circle, that men do not think. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. In Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography, he wrote, "The great masses of the people will more easily fall victim to a big lie than a small one." The book was widely read by the German people at the time. The masses believed him anyway. Or, at the very most, they ignored him. It is a fact that fewer than 10% of Germany's population of 79.7 million people actively worked or campaigned to bring about Hitler's change. Even at the height of its power in 1945, the Nazi political party boasted only 8.5 million members. So the remaining 90% of Germans, teachers and doctors and ministers and farmers, did what? Stood by? Watched? Essentially, yes. Mothers and fathers held their voices, covered their eyes, and closed their ears. The vast majority of an educated population accepted their salaries and avoided the uncomfortable truth that lingered over them like a serpent waiting to strike. And when the Nazis came for their children, it was too late. You see, it wasn't only the Jews who were persecuted. Today, most people are unaware that of the 11 million people exterminated, 5 million were not even Jewish. In Dachau, one of the largest and most infamous of all concentration camps, only a third of the population was Jewish. We've all heard of the yellow triangles the Jews were forced to wear for identification. Do you know the other colors that were used? Brown triangles identified gypsies and those of Roman descent. Purple triangles were worn by Jehovah's Witnesses, Catholic priests, and Christian leaders who ran afoul of the government. Black triangles marked one as a vagrant, worn by any person lacking documentation when asked for proof of a permanent address. Blue triangles were forced on those who had moved to Germany from other countries, unless they were Jewish, in which case they wore yellow. Red triangles were worn by a large and diverse group. You wore red if you were a member of a trade union, a Democrat, a Freemason, or any number of categories labeled as a political nonconformist. Pink badges identified homosexuals, though any suspected perpetrator of a sexual offense such as rape or pedophilia was also given a pink triangle. Green badges were given to common thieves and murderers, and since they were not suspect politically, these prisoners, called capos, were often in charge of the others. Purple badges. Red and pink and brown, blue and black, all worn by mothers and fathers and children who were not the first to be selected for the camps. Their badges were worn, their fates altered, well after they got a good look at the yellow ones. In at least one German town, the railroad tracks ran behind the church. An eyewitness stated, "We heard stories of what was happening to the Jews. But we tried to distance ourselves from it, because we felt, what could anyone do to stop it? Each Sunday morning we would hear the train whistle blowing in the distance, then the wheels coming over the tracks. We became disturbed when we heard the cries coming from the train as it passed by. We realized it was carrying Jews like cattle in the cars. Week after week the whistle would blow. We dreaded to hear the sounds of those wheels because we knew we would hear the cries of the Jews en route to a death camp. Their screams tormented us. We knew the time the train was coming, and when we heard the whistle blow, we began singing hymns. By the time the train came past our church, we were singing at the top of our voices. If we heard the screams, we sang more loudly, and soon we heard them no more. Years have passed, and no one talks about it now. But I still hear that train whistle in my sleep." With all we know now, does anyone believe that telling the truth will solve all a nation's problems? Of course not. But it is a beginning. In fact, speaking truth should be the least we require of our elected leaders. After all, what are our standards for being led? You see, the danger to America is not a single politician with ill intent, or even a group of them. The most dangerous thing any nation faces is a citizenry capable of trusting a liar to lead them. In the long run, it is much easier to undo the policies of crooked leadership than to restore common sense and wisdom to a deceived population willing to elect such a leader in the first place. Any country can survive having chosen a fool as their leader. But history has shown time and again that a nation of fools is surely doomed. Incredibly, there are currently 545 human beings who are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for every problem America faces. Have you ever wondered why America doesn't have a balanced budget? Have you ever in your life heard of a politician who wasn't for a balanced budget? Have you ever heard a politician speak in favor of a complicated tax code that ordinary citizens would find difficult to understand? Then why do we have a complicated tax code that ordinary citizens find difficult to understand? Meet the 545 men and women who enact every law, propose every budget, and set every policy enforced on the citizens of the United States of America. One president, 9 Supreme Court justices, 100 senators, and 435 members of the House of Representatives. By the way, have you ever noticed that if any one of us lies to them, it is a felony? But if any one of them lies to us, it is considered politics. According to the United States Bureau of the Census, our population has now increased beyond 311 million people. To be clear, that's 545 of them and 311 million of us. Can 311 million Americans ever hope to wrestle the power away from 545? One would think so. But did you know that during the past quarter century, no presidential election has been won by more than 10 million ballots cast? Yet every federal election during the same time period has had at least 100 million people of voting age who did not bother to vote. Knowing that the quality of one's answers can only be determined by the quality of one's questions, let's ask some good ones. Why do the ages of our world's greatest civilizations average around 200 years? Why do these civilizations all seem to follow the same identifiable sequence? From bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to complacency, from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependence, and finally from dependence back into bondage. Is lying to get elected acceptable? Even if the candidate's intention is to get elected in order to do good works? Is there really any power in one's intentions anyway? Have you ever noticed how we judge the bad guys by their actions and the good guys by their intentions? Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? Would truth be a starting point for telling the difference? What is our nation's course? Do you believe that one can determine a probable destination by examining the direction in which one is traveling? If so, where are we headed? Can you hear the whistle and the wheels as the train comes down the track? How loudly are you singing?
How Do You Kill 11 Million People by Andy Andrews was published by Thomas Nelson and recorded on location at Spotland Productions in Nashville, Tennessee. For more information on other fine books and audio products from Thomas Nelson, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at thomasnelson.com. Now, a behind-the-scenes conversation with Andy Andrews on the idea, thoughts, and answers that led him to write How Do You Kill 11 Million People? So, Andy, as we begin, just for the sake of your readers, tell us what you were trying to illustrate when you wrote this book.
Well, other than the subtitle, which is Why the Truth Matters More Than You Think, what this book illustrates is known as the principle of the path. Now, this was first voiced by Andy Stanley. The principle states it is direction, not intention, that determines destination. The principle of the path was also discussed in my book, The Final Summit, which is a story about what happens when historical figures like Winston Churchill, George Washington Carver, Joan of Arc, and others gather in order to solve a particular challenge. In The Final Summit, the characters inadvertently show that history itself is a path that can be examined at any point along the way in order to predict future results. So history is merely a broad version of our individual lives, right? I mean, do we see a pattern in our good choices? Do these good choices lead us to good results? Of course they do. Therefore, let us continue to make choices just like those good ones that proved beneficial in our lives. On the other hand, do we see a pattern in some bad choices we've made? Did those bad choices seem to connect the horrible, miserable dots that sank our life's results ever lower? Of course they did. So, let us determine we will never again make those choices. See, the only way we have to know a person who aspires to lead us is to listen to what he says and watch what he does. Frankly, what I might think of any current or past leader of the United States should be irrelevant to you. The questions most important in your life in regard to this subject should be, what criteria do you use to determine who leads your family? And what do you think?
I think one of the things that some of your readers are going to want to know, and they're probably asking the whole time they're reading this book, can you identify yourself, Andy, as a Republican or a Democrat, or where do you fall?
You know, I put this in the author's note, and I was very honest there. I'm not an us or them kind of person. I'm a we kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have a label in that regard. I'm a concerned American citizen who demands integrity from those who seek to lead our country. And frankly, I believe candidates from both parties have lied to the American people. Furthermore, I believe that many are slipping dangerously close to creating the habit of lying and rationalizing that their purpose in doing so is for our own good. I mean, I don't want discussion of this book to devolve into partisan bickering.
Right.
We have enough of that already. I didn't write this book in order to compare Hitler or the Nazis to any of our current or previous leadership, Republican or Democrat. And let me say this, it might be interesting for people to know that that phrase, redistribution of wealth, in the book was not used in the body of this text in order to draw comparisons between Adolf Hitler and any specific person. Actually, I tried to find another way to phrase that point, but ultimately, because it illustrated Hitler's style of saying what an audience wanted to hear, and because those particular words actually came from Hitler's mouth, I decided to go with what he really said. It has become standard operating procedure for many politicians to say whatever is needed in order to get elected. And this has got to stop. History's list is deep and wide and filled with the names of tragic governments whose citizens did not stop it.
Speaking of those citizens, you use some pretty strong language in here. Do you think the German population that allowed Hitler to come to power, were they really a nation of fools, as you said earlier?
Not necessarily. You got to understand that Germany at that time did not have the benefit of examining the history of the kind of tragedies of which they became a part. They were certainly a nation of misled people. They assumed that the leaders in whom they had placed their faith would put their best interests at the forefront. I mean, they were sincere in those beliefs,
right?
But as we know now, they were sincerely wrong.
And what about America? Are American people fools?
Well, I think the jury's still out on that question.
Mm.
I've always considered the American people smart and industrious. Unfortunately, we have all known smart people who have done foolish things. As a group, I mean, think about this. As a group, when more than 100 million of us don't bother to vote in a federal election, it certainly underscores the apathy portion of a nation's fatal sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So are we too trusting? Probably. Are we downright gullible? I'm afraid the evidence might support that. But are we fools? I'll give it a not yet.
All right. So to ask the audacious question, if you take out, you know, the logical train of thought where you're going in the book, are you suggesting that the United States is going to be the site of the world's next great Holocaust?
No, I'm not saying that it will happen. I am saying that it could happen, but that's the whole point of the book. History shows that any people who are sheep-like in following their leadership, so long as their personal self-interests are satisfied, that these people may one day awaken to find that their nation has changed in dramatic ways. It doesn't take many people to lead a nation in a direction that has serious repercussions on the liberty of others. And I think most of us will agree we have already given up liberties for various reasons, and we may never get them back.
Right.
Under certain circumstances, things can take very bad turns very quickly. And this cycle has repeated itself with many societies throughout history. So despite the solid foundation of our culture and our political system, America's not immune. You know, it was George Santayana who said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." But we, the people, can change this direction. But I got to tell you, know this, our portion of history is being written today. So everybody has to ask themselves, what will be remembered about my contribution?
You certainly hint at this in the book, but can you be more specific? Who's lying to our country right now?
Sorry, but I'm just not going to answer this question. The purpose of this book is to get you to answer that question for yourself. My point is that each of us must stop blindly believing everything someone with an agenda says. Today, with the advent of the internet search engines and sites like YouTube, it's a fairly simple thing to verify a politician's promises, voting record, personal life, and so on. So let's all work together. Post your proof online for all of us to read and pass along.
Fair enough. So let's switch gears for a second and talk about you personally, your motivation. Why did you choose to write this book, and why did you choose to write it now?
Look, our nation is at a tipping point. Regardless of anybody's political views, people everywhere can sense this. Did you know the United States of America is now the longest tenured government in the world?
Hmm.
I mean, there are countries older than us, but as far as one continuous form of government, we are the oldest, or the last, depending on how you look at it. And if we don't demand honesty and integrity from America's leadership now, and reward that integrity with our votes, our leaders will lack the fortitude to make the hard decisions that have to be made to change course. If our nation really is in a state of crisis, then we need to change before it's too late to choose the direction of that change. We need the correct and best possible people in office to make this happen. Now, some of them, of course, are already in office, but they need our help to surround them with men and women who will do what they believe is right and true. I wrote this book for you to use as a tool. I wrote it for you to give away. I wrote it for you to discuss and preach about and read to your children. I really believe that now, more than ever, America needs to be challenged and inspired to participate.
Well, are you doing something new here? Is this novel? I mean, there's been obvious debate, commentary from one situation to another across our history, but have the American people ever specifically been cautioned about the long-term consequences of electing leaders who don't have strong character?
Yes, actually, yes, we have been cautioned. Now, very few people remember the instance, but in retrospect, this is chilling to note the accuracy with which it was delivered. This was on the occasion of our nation's 100th birthday. I actually have part of the speech right here. This was in his centennial address to Congress in 1876, 100 years old, America is at this point, and President James A. Garfield issued this warning. This was widely reported in the press at the time. The entire speech was printed in newspapers. And listen to this part. He said, "Now, more than ever before, the people are responsible for the character of their Congress. If that body be ignorant, reckless, and corrupt, it is because the people tolerate ignorance, recklessness, and corruption. If that body of Congress be intelligent, brave, and pure, it is because the people demand these high qualities to represent them in the national legislature." Then he said, listen to this, "If 100 years from now, the next centennial does not find us a great nation, it will be because those who represent the enterprise, the culture, and the morality of the nation do not aid in controlling the political forces." So yes, we have been warned.
Well, Andy, how do we know if a politician is telling the truth? Is there a way we can really be sure?
Well, you remember that old joke, how do you know if a politician is lying,
right,
if he's moving his lips?
Right.
is, you know, it's not that funny anymore, is it? Obviously, I don't think there's a certain way to know at the moment that something is said. But remember this, past performance serves to reveal future behavior. A person who has exhibited a pattern of lying is a liar. I know that sounds rough, but can you think of another way to put it? This is why character in our leadership is so important. In my book, The Final Summit, Abraham Lincoln says to Joan of Arc, "Does adversity build character? It does not. Almost all people can stand adversity of one sort or another. If you want to test a person's character, give him power." And then Lincoln goes on to say, "Now, since we are concerning ourselves here with the very future of humanity, let me add one thing more. Power corrupts. Trust me on this. And because power corrupts, humanity's need for those in power to be of high character increases as the importance of the position of leadership increases." We are discussing character, correct? Not intelligence. Some of the most intelligent leaders in history have brought disaster to their nations because intelligence is powerless to modify character. Great leadership is a product of great character. And this is why character matters.
Well, that being the case, and if character is such a central and pivotal ethic for us as a country, and the politicians don't have it, who should we be listening to?
We should listen to ourselves. Listen to common sense and be mindful of, and then actually pay attention to what we already know to be true. And we desperately need to be honest with ourselves. We have to recognize that as voters, we sometimes accept a lie when it suits our own self-interest. That's why polls sometimes show that Americans are in favor of throwing everyone out of Congress except their own representatives, at least among the people who actually know who their representative is. And obviously, I can't be in favor of cutting spending and entitlements except the ones that benefit me or my hometown or the place I work. Unfortunately, that's often why we accept lies from politicians. It has become an accepted political strategy for politicians to tell the voters the lies we want to hear. We, in turn, reward them with elected positions even when we know we're not being told the truth.
Well, to play devil's advocate on the issue, Andy, how do we know that you're telling the truth?
That's a great question. You know, the internet can be a wonderful thing, and I really encourage readers to fact check what I say in this book against multiple credible sources. That's why I included a bibliography. I mean, these numbers, these facts are footnoted in the book. Read these books yourself. Examine the record. It's all there for anyone to see. And I might add, that's exactly what we should do every time some politician or member of the media says something that doesn't ring true to us. If we really care to check things out, the lies aren't that hard to detect.
And obviously, right now we're talking in the studio. This is going to be an audio book, and the people listening to us aren't going to have those footnotes because they don't have the physical book. So if you're listening to this, you can go find the footnotes that Andy's talking about. They're very insightful. They're important. They're really critical to getting the message of this book. You can go to andyandrews.com and find that list. So Andy, as a follow-up to that previous question, do you have a political agenda?
Yes, of course. And I sure hope you have one too. Here's mine. I want America's present and future leadership to embrace and live up to America's core principles as written by our founding fathers and set forth in our Constitution. In addition, I want the public to vigilantly hold them accountable for doing so. And that's my political agenda.
Well, can you provide an example, a real-world example today, where a situation in our country is being enabled because of disingenuous leadership?
Yes, certainly. I mean, there are many, but one such example was touched on briefly in the body of this work when I wrote, "Have you ever heard of a politician speaking in favor of a complicated tax code that ordinary citizens would find difficult to understand? Then why do we have a complicated tax code that ordinary citizens find difficult to understand?" Look, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but neither am I incredibly stupid. I believe most folks like me find the days and weeks leading up to April 15th to be, how should I put this, stressful. Okay, not because we object to paying taxes, but because we're afraid of doing it incorrectly and having to deal with the IRS if we have done so. The U.S. tax code is so convoluted and bewildering that few of us completely understand it, yet many politicians actually derive power from it. Through the years, congressional representatives and senators have manipulated the tax code for a bunch of reasons, such as accepting donations or helping powerful members of their districts back home. In any case, a complex tax code provides a certain cover for shady wheeling and dealing at election time. Therefore, there's not much incentive for politicians to simplify this process.
Well, on that note, final question, and probably the million-dollar question, who would you, Andy Andrews, elect as President of the United States?
Abraham Lincoln, but he won't run again. You know, seriously, I am searching for that one special leader who can look us in the eye while telling us the painful truth in such a way that still manages to resonate with voters. I know that's a tough order, but it can be done, especially if smart people will get involved in the election process and actually vote.
Indeed. Andy, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely.